From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is the Kids Listening Hour. Today, we follow a team of archaeologists into a deep underground cave.
It's the site of a major discovery in the history of humankind.
But to make it into the cave,
your entire body has to fit through the space of 7 inches.
Also, we'll hear the story of one of Mexico's greatest painters, Frida Kahlo.
Through her paintings, Frida gave herself a second life. She suffered a lot, but she painted herself as a hero.
We'll join a book club as they uncover a novel's hidden meanings.
It was kind of like an awakening for me, like, this is not this mystic fairy tale as it seemed before, like, this is like real life.
And hear a folktale about runaway cats.
He looked at his reflection in the water bowl. He had a cut on his cheek and was missing a big notch from one of his ears. I guess it could have been worse, he said to himself.
That's coming up on the Kids Listening Hour. Welcome to the Kids Listening Hour, a collection of stories, science, and more. My name is John. Today we're going to hear about underground explorers, a mysterious island, and runaway cats. And I want you to listen carefully because at the end of the show, I'm going to ask you the following 3 questions about what we've heard. Ready? What are the underground explorers looking for? Who is the protagonist of Orphan Island? When did Frida Kahlo begin painting? Let's get to answering that last question right now. From the podcast Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, here's the story of the great Mexican painter Frida Kahlo. It's narrated by the actress and writer Pamela Adlon.
Once upon a time, in a small town on the outskirts of Mexico City, there was a girl who lived in a blue house. Her name was Frida. From the outside, Frida's blue house was a common stucco building with bright blue walls, tall windows, and green shutters. But past the entrance, a world of wonder awaited. Tropical plants, fountains, a small pyramid decked with pre-Columbian idols, birds singing, and in the house, a big, heavy, and dark wooden closet, inside which Frida and her little sister sang revolutionary songs at the top of their lungs. It was an exciting and dangerous time in Mexico. A revolution had started. The Zapatistas fought fiercely to overthrow the dictatorship of Porfirio Díaz and to establish a constitutional republic. At 4, Frida had chosen the side she'd be on. The revolutionaries. Frida was a rebel. Her mom took her to church, but every time she managed to escape and spent entire afternoons wandering the courtyards of Coyoacán, where she ate cherries and quinces from all the trees she could find. When Frida turned 6, though, her life changed abruptly. She contracted polio and was bedridden for months. Polio was a serious disease, potentially lethal, and at first it seemed to tarnish Frida's adventurous spirit. Soon, however, it became clear that Frida would not be tamed so easily. When Frida recovered, the doctor recommended she play as many sports as she could, since polio had left her with a right leg that was weaker, thinner, and shorter than her left. With her father's encouragement, Frida started boxing, wrestling, playing soccer, and rowing. She even became a swimming champion. Despite all the exercise, her leg remained thinner and gave her a limp. Often, when she rode her bike, other kids screamed, "Frida, pata de palo!" Frida, wooden leg. She kept pedaling as fast as she could and angrily shouted back all the bad words she could think of. When Frida was 15, she started attending the best high school in Mexico, La Escuela Nacional Preparatoria. She wore her black hair short with a fringe. She had a thick unibrow, fierce dark eyes, and a light mustache. Under the dictatorship of Diaz, the country had been ruled by a group of men who looked at Europe as a model for the modernization of Mexico. In their view, food, economy, fashion, art, everything European was better than anything Mexican. It took 10 years of revolution to give Mexico back to Mexicans, and Frida's school was central in that process. "Let yourselves be inspired by the Mexican soil," the teacher said. "Look at our costumes, at our traditions, at our hopes and desires. Let yourselves be inspired by what we truly are." Frida and her schoolmates took that lesson to heart. At the new school, Frida had immediately found her crew, a group of 9 students called Los Cachucas. They were intelligent and reckless. Once, they brought a donkey to school and rode it up and down the hallways. Another time, they refused to attend a lesson and stood outside the classroom, reading aloud a book they thought was more interesting. When a famous Mexican painter called Diego Rivera came in to paint a huge mural in their school, Frida pranked him all the time. She stole his lunch and made fun of his girlfriends when they visited him. Diego was 36 years old and unbelievably fat. He wore a cowboy hat, huge miner's boots, and a big leather belt. Some say Frida fell in love there and then. But it would take a few years before their love story began. In the meantime, Frida got a boyfriend. His name was Alejandro. They did everything together. And when they were not together, they exchanged long letters. Frida filled her letters with drawings, and as soon as she started wearing lipstick, she stamped them all with kisses. One day, Frida and Alejandro hopped on one of the new buses that had just started to populate the streets of Mexico City. It was crowded, but they found 2 seats in the back. A few minutes later, a tram violently hit the bus. The bus seemed to bend impossibly. Then it burst into a million pieces. The metal handrail broke violently, and it impaled Frida, just like a sword. A passenger next to them was carrying a package full of powdered gold. The package broke during the collision, and the sparkling powder flew everywhere, gently coating Frida's bleeding body in gold. La bailarina, people shouted. They thought she was a dancer. Frida was rushed to the hospital, and for an entire month, it wasn't clear if she would survive. Her spine was broken in 3 places. Her collarbone was broken too. And her right leg was fractured in 11 places. Her right foot was crushed. Her convalescence took 2 years, and she never fully recovered, but she had survived. To overcome the consequences of polio, she had learned to become an athlete. Now, to recover from this terrible accident, she had to learn how to stay still. So, she began to paint. Frida could not sit, so her mother had a special easel made, one that allowed her to paint while lying in bed. She started painting the friends who came to visit her, her relatives, and herself. I paint myself, she wrote, because I am so often alone, and because I am the subject I know best. Unable to see the world outside, she saw it in her body. Valleys and mountains, flowers and buildings. Through her paintings, Frida gave herself a second life. She suffered a lot, but she painted herself as a hero. A woman capable of surviving and thriving on even the most hostile and desolated planet. In her self-portraits, she never looked pitiful. She stood with the dignity of a queen and with a fire in her eyes.
And that's only the beginning of Frida's story. If you want to hear the rest or any of the other really fantastic stories, check out the podcast Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, based on the book of the same name. Pamela Adlon read that one. Your parents might know her from her FX series, Better Things. Now, let's go on a journey of discovery and danger with Lindsay Patterson and Marshall Escamilla of the science podcast Tumble. They spoke with archaeologists who work deep underground.
There we go.
Can you hear us?
Yes, I can.
Oh, great.
Hi, I'm Marina and Becca.
My name's Becca.
And we have Kenny here as well.
Hello.
I'm sitting at my desk talking over Skype to Marina Elliott, Becca Pisciotto, and Kenny Molepanier. They're part of a team of archaeologists working in South Africa. But it's kind of an unusual interview setup. They're in a cave 30 meters underground.
Whoa, that's like 100 feet.
Sorry, Lindsay, give us a second while we try to get ourselves into a place in the cave that's actually reasonably comfortable and you can see us. All right, the challenges of, you know, doing interviews from underground.
So, how do you get Skype in a cave? Is there just like a desktop in there when they got in?
It's a lot of wiring and then Wi-Fi.
Becca, Marina, and Kenny squeezed together to fit into the screen. They were wearing hard hats with headlamps and pants with reflective tape. They were sitting in what's called the Dinaledi Chamber of the Rising Star Cave System, about 50 miles from Johannesburg. It's the site of a major discovery in the history of humankind, Homo naledi. Here's Becca.
Homo naledi is an early hominid. We don't know if it's an ancestor or probably more like a cousin. And it's about 250,000 years old. So far, it's only been found in this one cave system in South Africa.
Hominid is the name of the group of species that includes modern humans and our extinct relatives, like Neanderthals. The caves in this part of South Africa have been a hotbed of hominid discovery for the past 100 years. Homo naledi was one of the biggest finds ever. They found not just one specimen or one body, but 15.
So how did they find this? Was there like a treasure map and a pirate going like, "Arr! If you look here, you'll find my buried treasure of a bunch of monkey bones."
Well, it didn't happen quite like that. Back in 2013, two cavers were exploring the cave system when they found a tiny gap in the cave wall. They squeezed through it into an open chamber, and with the light from their headlamps, they saw bones literally scattered across the surface of the floor.
Wow, but if people had been exploring caves in the area for 100 years, how did they miss these fossils just laying out in the open?
Well, to say it's hard to get to the Dinaledi chamber would be a total understatement. I'll let Kenny describe how she, Becca, and Marina get there every day.
Our first obstacle is the Superman's crawl. We would get down on our bellies and just wiggle our way through this tunnel.
Oh boy. I couldn't do that.
Yeah, there's lots of small spaces. Superman's crawl is less than 10 inches high.
Oh my gosh.
And that's just the beginning. Next comes a climb up a jagged rock wall.
And then you climb up Dragon's Back, jump over Leap of Faith, which is a meter distance leap from one point to the next point.
Dragon's Back, Leap of Faith. My goodness. This just sounds like a one of the most super intense things a person can do.
And then we enter into what I call the crystal chandelier chamber, where you like unclip your harness and sort of brace yourself for facing the chute.
This is the gut-clenching part, the chute. It's what kept Dina Letty Chamber a secret for hundreds of thousands of years. It's literally a crack in the wall.
And the chute has an 18-centimeter pinch point, which is where you hold your breath, say a little prayer, and squeeze through. And then, yeah, then you make it into the chamber, the fossil chamber.
Hold on, did she say 18 centimeters?
Yes, that's 7 inches.
That's like the size of 2.5 Hot Wheels cars laid end to end.
I love that that's your unit of measurement.
Isn't that everybody's unit of measurement?
Yeah. So your entire body has to fit through the space of 2.5 Hot Wheels cars.
Oh my gosh. I can't do that.
That's Marshall Escamilla and Lindsay Patterson talking with a team of archaeologists deep underground on their podcast, Tumble. We'll hear some more in just a minute, and join a book club discussion of a novel about a mysterious island. That's after a break. This is the Kids Listening Hour. This is the Kids Listening Hour. My name is John. Let's get back to the science podcast Tumble, where hosts Lindsay Patterson and Marshall Escamilla are talking over Skype to archaeologists who are working deep underground uncovering fossils.
On the original expedition in 2013, Marina and Becca helped collect the first bones of Homo naledi that had ever been studied.
We excavated just one unit, which was basically 80 centimeters by 80 centimeters by 20 centimeters deep. We took some material off the surface, but all told, we ended up with about 1,500 fossil fragments.
Wow, that's incredible, like having a 1,500-piece puzzle with no photo on the box.
Yeah, and it was a species that no one had ever seen before.
So definitely no photo on the box.
Scientists carefully constructed 15 skeletons from the 1,500 fossil pieces. Then they were able to imagine what Homo naledi would have looked like while they were alive. Becca kind of painted a picture for me.
If you were to see a Homo naledi on the street, you would not think that it looked a lot like us.
But it still has a lot in common with humans.
It walked on 2 feet. Its feet, in fact, look an awful lot like ours.
It was really short. Even the adults were under 5 feet tall.
On the reconstructions, the head of Homo naledi looks kind of small for its body.
Its brain was less than half the size of ours. Its forehead had a steep slope, kind of like an ape.
And then it has shoulders that are a lot like a gibbon.
It also had long, curved fingers like a modern-day monkey.
That suggests to us that maybe Homo naledi was still doing lots of climbing in some way.
But the bones in its thumbs and wrists suggest that they could have used tools, which is like a really advanced skill for most species.
So what does this discovery tell us about humans?
Here's what Marina said.
You know, the human family tree is a lot bushier than people sometimes make it out to be.
It's not just a straight line from one ancient hominid species down to us.
At the 350 to 250,000 year point, certainly in Africa, you know, anatomically modern humans were already on the landscape.
So, like, we might have had some Homo naledis over for a party.
Or we could have been fighting with them.
I mean, maybe both. God, we're not inviting the naledis over again. They always smash the table and steal all the fruit.
They're not even that good at using spoons. Anyhow, scientists are starting to piece together what it would have looked like to have several hominid species on Earth at one time. The fact that we discovered Homo naledi so recently proves that there's still so much out there to find.
It's pretty exciting to find a bunch of bones that belong to a creature that hadn't been described before in science. That, you know, nobody'd ever seen before.
So if they were able to construct Homo naledi from that first expedition, why do they keep coming back to the cave?
That's a really good question, and here's Marina's answer.
I think it's really important not just to, you know, bring these initial fossils up and go, okay, we know all about Homo naledi, because we really don't.
In other words, they want to know what more there is to discover. And there are definitely more fossils left.
We've already hit quite a lot of bone.
So what are they hoping to find out?
I mean, one of the, I think the big questions is why and how were they getting into this deep area of the cave.
The big mystery is how Homo naledi ended up in a place that's nearly impossible to access.
Maybe there was an easier entrance to the cave that, you know, closed up sometime in the last 250,000 years.
That's definitely a possibility that they're exploring. But how did so many bones end up there? There's no evidence that Homo naledi actually lived in the cave. No plants, no other bones of other animals, no nothing. Here's the best idea scientists have. The Dinaledi chamber was actually a burial ground.
We're still working on the hypothesis that Homo naledi was deliberately bringing its dead into this very difficult to access space. You know, we've been at it for 5 years now and we haven't found a better explanation.
Many scientists don't believe that such a small brain species could have had funerals. That's part of the reason why Marina, Becca, Kenny, and others keep looking for more fossils that might give us more clues to the mystery.
You don't sort of find the answer and that's the end of it and you can kind of wash your hands and go home. Every time we come out, we find something new, and every time we find something new, we revise our, you know, ideas based on the new evidence.
Okay, so how does one, not me, but someone, become an underground astronaut?
All three women told me that they couldn't have predicted that they'll be sitting in a cave, digging up precious fossils, and doing podcast interviews. But they all had adventurous experiences that somehow led them there. Marina had this advice.
Try everything and anything. Try things you think you'll like. Try things you think you might not like. Do it safely, but be curious and get out there.
Kenny, do you have anything you want to add?
Adventure!
That was the science podcast Tumble, hosted by Lindsay Patterson and Marshall Escamilla. Kitty Feldy records her podcast, The Book Club for Kids, in different places across the country, bringing in new groups of young readers to discuss their favorite books. In this episode, Kitty spoke with Eleanor, Anna, Helen, and Charlotte in Oak Park, Illinois, to talk about the novel Orphan Island by Laurel Snyder. And parents, keep an ear out for the celebrity reader later on.
Orphan Island is a big island, obviously, where all these kids are shipped in, like, on a boat. And every year, the oldest orphan goes onto the boat, and a new orphan is brought onto the island, and the oldest orphan takes care of the youngest one and gets them ready.
There are all these rules on the island that they all have and they all follow, and no one has any idea where they came from, but they're there and they have to do it. There's all these traditions. And in the book, you can definitely see that some people try to challenge them and some people just follow them blindly. And it's interesting to see, like, the contrast between those characters.
There's a rhyme they follow, which is like, 9 children, orphans all, any more the skies will fall. So that's, like, why most of them follow the rules and just continue to, like, repeat this cycle over and over again.
And so the main character in the book is Ginny, and she has to see her best friend Dean leave because he was the elder and now it was his turn to leave. And she really has a hard time with that because they were so close. And now that she's the elder, she has to cope with the fact that she has to leave, and she loves the island and she doesn't want to leave it.
Let's hear a little bit from Orphan Island. The scene takes place on the day that Jenny is supposed to leave the island. Our reader is Congressman Adam Schiff from California.
She turned to face the boat. She took a step. She took another step. She leaned forward and stared out at the water beyond the boat. The cold water shrouded in mist, full of dark fins like knives, vast creatures beneath. Jenny shivered. And then, before she knew what she was doing, she had pushed the boat sharply away, out into the water, empty. "Ginny," asked Ben in his measured voice. Ginny ignored him, kept her back turned to him, watched the green boat drift for a moment. "Ginny," Ben repeated himself, "are you okay?" Still, Ginny ignored him. She was watching the boat, waiting for it to wander, to float out to sea. "Shh," she said, a finger to her lips. The problem was that the boat didn't drift. It sat for a moment a few feet away, as though confused. Then it zipped right back up to the shore beside Ginny's legs and gave a gentle nudge, bumped her shin softly. "Ouch," she whispered. "Ginny," asked Ben one more time. Now Ginny grabbed the sides of the boat forcefully and stomped out into the water until it was up to her knees. She pulled the boat along with her as she waded farther, until the water was up to her waist, until her tunic pockets were filled with air. She pushed the boat again as hard as she could away from her. The green boat tried to double back again. Ginny grabbed it and gave it a shake. "Go," she said at the boat. "Go home." "Ginny," called Ben again from the shore. "This is crazy. What are you doing?" "I'm staying," said Ginny, slapping the side of the boat wetly, sending a splash up into the air. "Can't you see? I'm not going. Except the stupid boat isn't listening to me." As if on cue, the boat zipped back past Ginny again, up to the sand. Ginny stomped after it. "Stupid boat, do as I say. Go home." "Can you do that?" asked Evie. "Can she do that?" But nobody answered. "Ginny." Ben reached out to touch Ginny's shoulder as she came back ashore. She shrugged off his gentle touch. "Leave it alone, Ben." "I'm not going. You don't know where the boat goes. You don't know what's out there. It could be horrible out there," Ben urged. "You just have to believe in it. You just have to trust." "Trust who? Why? Why should I trust anyone? There are no reasons, only rules. Why should I get in a boat just because it happens to show up one day?" "Everybody else has done it," said Ben. "So what? I'm not everyone else. Maybe everyone else is drowned." "Well, S, she needs me. I don't want to let her down. And she isn't ready," said Ginny. "She's ready," said Ben. "She's sad. She's crying. Look at her." "We all get sad. We all cry," said Ben. "But that doesn't mean we won't be okay. You have to go." Ginny set her hands on her hips. "Make me," she said firmly.
Ginny breaks the rules. She decides to stay, and all hell breaks loose.
Well, with the rhyme, it's saying, like, how there needs to be 9 orphans and the sky might fall. Things just start going wrong, and it's not their safe island. It's the wilderness. It's, like, no longer magical.
And, like, bad things start to happen. So, like, they used to go to this cliff to jump off, and then the wind would catch them and bring them back onto the cliff. But one of them discovers that when they throw some snaps or char food that they eat over the cliff, they just fall into the water. Ginny starts acting very selfishly. Like, before she realized that everything wasn't going to exactly work out in her way, she wanted everything to be perfect. She wanted everybody to follow the rules, and she wanted everything to go as planned. But then when she realizes that the rules aren't quite in her favor, she decides that she wants to start bending the rules. So she kind of changes the character. And as a person?
Yeah, she is selfish. She wants everything to be her way. Like, she is almost holding the other orphans hostage. I mean, it's not their turn to go, but when it is, like, one of the characters talks about saying how he's worried about when it's his time to go, is he going to be allowed to leave? And also the problem of if these orphans are going to live there forever, they're eventually going to grow old, and they're going to leave the youngest alone.
So Ginny is the main character. Do you like her? Do you not like her?
I mean, obviously, if I met her in real life, I wouldn't really like her as a person. But I definitely like how in the story the author portrays, instead of having a perfect hero, they put the imperfections straight in front. And I think that does make me like the character, because it's definitely a new way to show her. And I liked how that worked out in the story.
With Ginny, she was just trying to, like, help everyone, even though she's making mistakes, which is what I liked, because she can make a mistake but still be a good person afterwards. Books with perfect heroes, they're easy to read, and sometimes they're kind of, like, pleasant to read because it's not as painful, I guess, as when there's an imperfect character. But imperfect characters are much more interesting to read about because they usually, like, develop more by the end of the book.
Did this book remind you of anything else you've ever read?
In the very beginning, I was thinking Hunger Games, only because there are just a bunch of children on an island, and there's obviously no fight to the death. But there was a survival aspect to it that made me think Hunger Games, except not fully, obviously.
In the beginning, I might have thought it would be a little Lord of the Flies-y, and it did resemble that throughout the rest of the story. just because there's all these kids and they're trying to have this, you know, there's this power balance and there's all these rivalries and there's so much going on. But in the beginning, I thought it was going to be a tiny bit like Harry Pottery, just because like it seemed like a mystical thing, all these kids together, you know, and it seems like there's magic, but that didn't really come through.
I want to go back to something about Jenny, because she is hormonally changing in this book. And so much of her behavior, I sort of became aware, a lot of that was because of she was going to, you know, start her period for the first time. Talk to me a little bit about that part of the book. I don't read a lot of books that have menstruation themes going on in them.
When I first started reading it, it confused me a little bit because I didn't really know what was going on. It didn't come to me immediately. But when it did, I kind of realized that, like, it seems like the island might be timing itself to take away kids when that starts happening, just so that they can be there for, like, you know, the less confusing part of their lives. They can all be together. And then when that starts happening, it just kind of snatches them up.
And one of the other boys said the elders always get a little weird at the end, which might be because they're starting to go through changes and just, like, mental changes and physical changes.
And thinking about this makes me think, like, the island's, like, a representation of, like, a sanctuary of, like, when you're, like, a really young child before you're, like, hit abruptly by the real world.
I had assumed that the message of the story was that, like, there's a greater purpose, but I suppose that sort of can change the message of the story in that you do have to grow up eventually and you can't stop it. You know, you have to move on.
When it came up in the book, it was kind of like an awakening for me, like, this is not this mystic fairy tale as it's seen before, like, this is, like, real life.
It was definitely a very unexpected theme for me. I think that's kind of what made it resonate a little.
I want to come back to what you said about fighting growing up, because I can remember not wanting to grow up too fast. I remember specifically being about your age, maybe a little younger, and not wanting to be an adult yet. Is that something that you have felt?
Yeah, I grew up around surrounded by boys, and we'd always hung out and had sleepovers, and it never seemed like a big deal. And then I went into middle school, and we were about to have a sleepover, and it just seemed almost awkward, and I didn't like that. They'd just pretty much been my brothers that I had never had. So, yeah, I have tried to fight it.
I think I'm kind of more like Dean in the sense that I want to know what's going to happen ahead. Like Dean says, well, maybe I want to know what's going to happen ahead. Didn't you ever think about that? And I think that's kind of what it's like for me, because I really want to know what comes ahead.
Being a kid is pretty fun and cool. Like, but everybody's curious about what growing up is like and what you're going to be when you grow up and all that. So I kind of understand both perspectives.
Let's just talk briefly about Abigail.
The mysterious girl in the letters, Abigail. So talk to me a little about that.
Well, so I was doing some analyzing of her letters. And so at first, well, Charlotte shared this opinion with me. At first, I thought, like, well, maybe when I read the letters, she was sent away because of the war or something. Like, it was, like, World War I or II. But then as I analyzed the story further, they talked about books like Harry Potter and Roald Dahl books. And I realized that Harry Potter was not written that long ago. So I realized, is this set in some future? Because there are 80 pairs of shoes on the island. It just made me think, like, this has been going on for, like, 80 years then. So, like, when is this set? And it doesn't seem like it's set in the future at all.
I thought Abigail's letter kind of proved that it maybe wasn't a whole dystopian world after all, because, like, she talked about playing soccer and eating spaghetti. So it's obviously not some, like, weird Hunger Games-ish kind of world outside the island.
It is really hard to try to pinpoint when this story might have been set, because all of the books have really, really yellowed pages, and they're really old. And, like, you don't really know if that's from age or just being used a lot. And so you want to know how long things have been here.
That was the Book Club for Kids, hosted by Kitty Feldy, with celebrity reader Congressman Adam Schiff, of all people. They discussed Laurel Snyder's novel, Orphan Island. Coming up, we hear a story of friendship and hardship and cats. This is the Kids Listening Hour. This is the Kids Listening Hour. My name is John. finally, let's hear a tale from Stories Podcast. Here, host Amanda Weldon narrates a Japanese folk tale adapted by Daniel Hines. It's called Runaway Cats.
Once upon a time, there lived a mighty kitten. Though young, he was tall and strong, with thick paws and shaggy fur that twisted up from his ears. In the starlight, his green eyes seemed to shine and pierce the gloom, letting him see even on the darkest night. He was quick and clever and kind, and his name was Goen. By day, Goen stayed inside with his owner, a kindly music teacher. There, he would sleep above the warm stove. He'd catnap and listen with half an ear while his master taught students about pitch and timbre and the intricate workings of music theory. By night, he prowled the alleys, menacing the mice and leaping wall to wall. Next door lived a beautiful kitten by the name of Koma. Where Goen's fur was long and wild, hers was short and soft as silk. And where Goen was huge, she was petite, tiny even for a kitten. She lived in the home of a great lady, who gave her as gentle a life as you could wish for. Koma did everything carefully and quietly. The little dear would blink her dainty eyelashes and eat her supper tidily, and when she finished, she licked her little pink nose with a delicate tongue. Every deed she did was done with grace, and she was her owner's pride and joy. Of course, it was only a matter of time before these two kittens should meet. One chance night, while Goen was out hunting mice and Koma was taking herself for a midnight stroll, they happened upon each other under a cherry tree. There, while the pink petals danced and laughed in the moonlight, they became fast friends. They spent all night together, talking and laughing and meowing songs at the moon. They met again the next night, and every night after. Soon, the two cats were best friends and thought it would be better if they could live in the same house. That way, they could be together during the day as well as during the night. It was a lovely idea, but there was just one problem. Neither owner was willing to part with their cat. Goen's owner, the music teacher, thought that Goen brought him luck. The lady who owned Koma took too much joy in doting on her. Neither was willing to part with their cat, no matter how much the two whined at them. One desperate night, the pair met again under their cherry tree. "My owner will not let me go," said Goen. "He says I keep his voice sweet and his purse full." Koma purred anxiously. "Mine says much the same. I don't think they'll let us live together." Goen paused, and then he remembered one of the haikus his master would sing just for practice. He said it aloud to Koma. "Meeting you was a happy surprise. The sunshine at summer's dawning." That was it. They both knew that they'd rather live on the streets together than in their houses apart. Cats are a decisive sort of creature, and so, their decision made, they left that very night. They turned their back on the cherry tree and followed the moon, laughing and singing and winding their way from one street to the next. As morning dawned, they found themselves in a large park. The grass was soft and the trees cast dancing shadows in the gentle breeze. "This seems like a good place to sleep away a sunny day," Koma said.
"Absolutely," agreed Goen, stretching deeply, belly to the ground. "Let's find a shady tree."
The pair padded across the soft grass, leaning against each other, tails dancing as they walked. It was a beautiful morning, and they were truly hopeful for their future together. And that's when they heard the dog. It stomped from the shadow of a tree, muzzle bared, teeth festooned with thick strings of drool. It eyed the cats and growled, a low, deep growl like rumbling earth.
"Koma," said Goen, "get up a tree."
Koma looked at him for a moment and then scrambled up a tree. The dog lunged after the tiny kitten, but Goen got in his way. The cat arched his back, hair on end to seem even bigger than he already was. The dog paused for a moment, unsure. It sniffed at the air, and Goen could tell the mutt-tasted cat on the breeze. He started to worry. Big as he was, the dog was much bigger. He darted for the tree, but the dog was too close and it cut him off. Goen spun the other way and the dog circled him there, too. Trapped. I'm trapped, he thought. From her perch high in the tree, Koma looked on. She was too small to fight, but she spied a human girl walking through the park nearby. Taking a deep breath, she yowled for all she was worth. Excuse me! Help us! The human heard her cry and turned towards the sound, cocking her head. Oh, was that a kitty I heard? She called, walking towards Koma's tree. Here, kitty, kitty! The girl drew near and saw the dog corner Goen and lunge forward. Its great big teeth snapped at the cat's head, and Goen yelped and stumbled away, bleeding from one ear. No, stop that, the girl said, walking between the cat and dog. The dog lowered its ears and slunk away, and the girl scooped the bloody Goen up into her arms. Before Koma could get out of the tree, the girl had tucked the big kitty into her basket and walked away. No, Goen, she called, hurrying after him. Unfortunately, the girl walked up to a towering gate set into a towering wall protected by guards with towering spears. The guards opened a small door for her and she hurried through, and it shut behind her with a booming clang. Koma ran up, trying to find a way through, but there were no holes and the wall was high and smooth. What do I do now? She said to herself miserably. What in the world can I do? Goen woke up the next morning in a bed of pillowed silk. Nearby there were bowls of food and water, and he could hear humans chatting in the next room. He climbed from bed, confused. Where am I? He wondered. He went to itch his head and his ear stung painfully. It hurt, but it brought the memories back in a rush. The park. The dog. Koma! Goen looked all around, but Koma wasn't there. He'd have to go find her. While he thought, his belly rumbled, so he helped himself to the food and drink. Whiskers wet, he looked at his reflection in the water bowl. He had a cut on his cheek and was missing a big notch from one of his ears. Well, he said to himself, I guess it could have been worse. At least Koma got away. Oh, kitty, you're awake! It was the girl, the one who'd saved him in the park. She scooped him up again and poked and prodded at his ear. At first it hurt, and Goen considered giving her some claw, but then she spread on some kind of paste that felt wonderfully cool and soothing. After that, she brought Goen outside and stood on a balcony. You see, kitty? She asked, holding him up. It's the Imperial Gardens. You live here at the palace now, you lucky cat. The palace, he thought with wonder. It turned out the girl worked in the palace, and she gleefully showed him the kitchens dripping with food, the sparkling water that leapt from the fountains, and the beautiful ponds full of slow, fat fish. There was wonder after wonder. It was a marvelous place, truly, a cat's paradise. And in the middle of it all stood a beautiful grove of cherry trees. I need to find Koma, he thought. She should be here with me. That day he prowled the grounds, looking for a way out so he could find her. Try as he might, he couldn't find a way through the walls, and they were too high and steep to climb. He found a gutter he thought was promising, but it was sealed halfway down with an iron grate. Goen wanted to scream in frustration. He lived in a paradise, but it wasn't truly a paradise without Koma. He had to find her. Had to. While he sat and thought, he watched a young girl walk across the Imperial Gardens. He didn't pay her too much attention until she sat under a rustling tree. That bothered Goen for a second. Why was that tree rustling and no other? There wasn't a breeze. He padded closer and saw it. There, in the reddish leaves of the tree, there was a great, rust-brown mamushi snake, one of the deadliest in all of Japan. It was uncoiling itself slowly, tongue flicking at the air. Oh, no, Goen realized. It was getting ready to drop on the girl and give her its terrible bite. Without thinking, the rough-and-tumble cat ran towards her. At the same moment, the snake hissed as it dropped, and the girl looked up and screamed as it lashed at her face. Its needle-sharp fangs extended, the mamushi struck like a lightning bolt. But Goen was faster. His reflexes sharp from hunting the quick street mice, he leapt and caught the snake in the air just inches from the young girl's cheek. With the snake in his teeth, Goen landed and shook his head, whipping the serpent back and forth until it went still in his jaws. He dropped it to the ground, panting. Some palace guards ran up, axes and swords at the ready.
"Princess, we heard the scream!"
They looked and saw the snake, sprawled on the ground.
"A deadly mamushi! Were you bitten?"
"No," said the girl, still a little shaky. "This kitty saved me." A pair of guards carried the snake away, while some others checked nearby trees for more.
"He looks like the fighting type,"
the guard said, scratching Goen behind his torn ear.
"Lucky for you."
"He's a hero, kitty."
"He is indeed,"
said the guard, smiling.
"Such heroism deserves a reward. Maybe a fish from the pond, or a golden collar. What do you think, princess?"
The little girl furrowed her brow in thought and turned towards Goen. "Kitty, you saved my life! How can I reward you?" Goen's heart leapt. They called her princess. He had saved the princess. This was his chance. Hoping she would understand, he ran over to the gate and scratched it with his paws. "You want to go out?" She nodded to the guards, who pulled open a small door set within the larger gate. Goen darted out and then turned to look at the princess, waiting. "You want me to come with you?" Goen ran to her and then back away again, eyeing her expectantly. "Guards, we're going on a walk with my cat." The guards smiled and were happy to humor the little princess. They made quite a parade leaving the castle. Goen in the lead, tail swaying, the imperial princess just behind, giggling and spinning, and the guards bringing up the rear with their long spears and ceremonial swords. It wasn't long before Goen spotted Koma. She was huddled in the shadow of the endless wall, looking longingly at the palace peaks beyond. "Koma!" he shouted, practically pouncing on her. "I found you!" "Goen," she replied, purring loudly. "You found me!" The princess and the guards caught up to the cats. The little girl was red-cheeked and laughing. "My hero! Is this your kitty friend?" Goen purred in response, nuzzling Koma's little pink nose with his own. "It is!" cried the princess. And then she turned to the guards, following her. "All right, everybody, these are both my kitties now. They'll be coming back with us." The guards cheered and the princess scooped up both cats. They hung awkwardly in her little arms, pressed together close, cheek to cheek, but they didn't seem to mind. And as time went on, the princess married a prince who came to love Goen and Koma just as much as his bride. The imperial couple had many children, and Goen and Koma had many little kittens of their own. The kids and kittens all played together, and they were fast friends for the rest of their lives, which they lived together, happily ever after. The end.
That was Runaway Cats, a Japanese folktale adapted by Daniel Hines. It's from his show, Stories Podcast. I didn't mention cats, but at the beginning of the show, I did ask you to listen out for the answers to three questions. Remember? Number one, what are the underground explorers looking for? If you answered fossils, you're right. The archaeologists were exploring a deep cave looking for the fossilized remains of Homo naledi, probably a distant cousin to modern humans. It's super cool that they're doing it. Not for me. Number two, who is the protagonist of Orphan Island? Protagonist is another word for main character or hero, and if you answered Ginny, you're right. Although Ginny sounded like a complicated hero, for sure. Number three, when did Frida Kahlo begin painting? And as we heard from TV's Pamela Adlon, the great Mexican artist began painting when she was a teenager, recovering from a devastating bus accident. The accident completely changed her life, and was a big influence in her work. If you want to hear the rest of Frida's story or any of the other podcasts you heard today, check out kidslisten.org. Kids Listen is a nonprofit dedicated to making great kids podcasts and has collaborated with WHYY to make this show. Speaking of which, did you like this show? If you did, or if you didn't, please, and I'm speaking to parents here, let us know. Go to whyy.org/soundingboard. It's where we test new shows and get feedback from you. This has been the Kids Listening Hour. I'm John Sheehan. Thank you for listening.